During the 2008 and 2009 academic year, visitors to the Allen Memorial Art Museum were treated to the first ever survey of British art from its collection in an exhibition called Out of Albion. Albion is an ancient term and romantic epithet for the islands comprising England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. The exhibition demonstrated to museum goers the numerous artistic achievements of Great Britain over the course of the last 8 centuries. From medieval illuminated manuscripts to some of the major players of the modern British art scene. One of the narrative strands that runs through the exhibition is the question of national artistic identity. Here, Colette Crossman, curator of academic programs and organizer of the exhibition, addresses this theme.
Prior to the 16th century, monasteries really served as the primary artistic centers in England. They were producing mainly illuminated manuscripts and other kinds of sacred art. With the Protestant Reformation, however, the royal court became the primary patron, and they were promoting secular subjects such as portraiture and the foreign-born artists who seemed to excel at those genres. Until the end of the 17th century, the great works of the English court were being made by painters like Hans Holbein from Germany or Anthony van Dyck from Flanders, bringing in styles that were originating from outside of Britain.
By the turn of the 18th century, Britain's rising political power on the world stage led to an increase in nationalist sentiment. As part of a concerted effort to develop native artistic talent, King George III founded the Royal Academy of Arts, a school and exhibition venue, in 1768. Sir Joshua Reynolds, the leading portraitist during the latter half of the 18th century, was chosen to lead the academy as its first president.
In the 18th century, British artists were pushing hard to promote their professional status and establish a national painting tradition, but they had differing opinions as to how that should come about and what form it should take. Reynolds, for example, promoted a conservative approach based on figure drawing, history painting, and imitating the old masters, ideas which were really codified in the training offered by the academy. Other painters of this time period, like Henry Fuseli and William Blake, were much more anti-establishment and anti-academy, preferring to break the molds of the old masters instead of replicating them. They privileged individualism, originality, and imagination in painting. In essence, they embraced the idea of the romantic genius.
One of the major issues for the new National Academy was finding inspiration from sources that were uniquely British. Many artists turned to the works of Britain's greatest national poet, William Shakespeare. Amanda Schubert, a student who assisted in the exhibition, discusses the role of Shakespeare as a model for British artists.
So as 18th century artists look back on their tradition of visual culture, they saw the imported tradition of foreign court portraitists. But British literary legacy, specifically writers like Milton and Shakespeare, proved to be rich and vital and generative for artists, especially Fuseli and Blake. Fuseli was trained in classical literature before he became a painter, and his visual work is infused with a belief in the power of poetic imagery to define human experience. Shakespeare, for artists like Fuseli, was seen as the paragon of British artistic self-expression, and the cult of Shakespeare as the divinely inspired poetic genius stood in for the legacy of the old masters.
This romantic notion of the artistic genius was perhaps best embodied by William Blake, poet, painter, and engraver. Blake was an eccentric visionary whose mystical themes and innovative forms were interwoven with a complex personal mythology, expounding the primacy of the individual imagination.
Blake was a visionary who believed deeply in the transformative power of the aesthetic. Art, both text and image, had an almost religious redemptive potential that set a precedent for future generations of artists.
The legacy of the Romantics inspired a new group of artists in the 19th century who espoused a philosophy of art for art's sake and expanded their practice to embrace the decorative arts. Known as the aesthetic movement, they effectively broke from the narrative traditions and academic conventions established and promoted by the Royal Academy.
James McNeill Whistler was part of a group of artists in the last half of the 19th century who was moving away from academic art and was much more concerned with the idea of art as beauty or art for its own sake. These artists believed that art didn't need to have any kind of moral or didactic message. Their idea was really that painting was a form of abstract beauty in the same way that music is.
In 1877, a dispute erupted between James McNeill Whistler and John Ruskin, the most prominent art critic of the century. Ruskin took exception to Whistler's most recent work, Nocturne in Black and Gold, The Falling Rocket, a painting of fireworks against a night sky, rendered as gold splashes against a dark, murky landscape. Ruskin, taking offense at the seeming lack of labor involved, published this famous insult: "I have seen and heard much of Cockney impudence before now, but never expected to hear a coxcomb ask 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint in the public's face." A court case later ensued and addressed the age-old question, what is art and what makes it valuable?
So Whistler takes Ruskin to trial and basically sues him for libel, saying that art is about the originality of the artist. It should be about the idea behind the artwork and not the labor that went into it. So in Whistler's idea, you're really paying 100 guineas for the artist's genius. Whistler was really pitting this idea of romantic genius against the more academically trained painter coming out of that tradition of Reynolds.
Whistler's 1878 libel suit against Ruskin formed a dramatic climax to tensions about artistic identity that had been growing in England since the 18th century.
It was all the scandal in the art world and in the social world as well, because Whistler was certainly a prominent member of the social and cultural circles in London, and all of the great artists of the day were called in to testify, either on Whistler's behalf or Ruskin's behalf, and it created all kinds of rivalries and rifts within the art world.
Ultimately, Ruskin's theories were defeated, and the outcome of the trial shaped the course of international modernism.
In the end, Whistler wins the libel suit, but he's only awarded a farthing in damages, which is basically like a penny. So he's bankrupt from that point on. But he won the argument, and it really opened up possibilities for artists and really the beginnings of modernism as we know it.
Beginning in the early 20th century, small circles of artists emerged in Britain, forging influential new styles and forms through experimentation with abstraction and the pursuit of innovation. These modernist currents dominated the British art world until the 1950s, when a new generation of artists began to challenge traditional distinctions such as high art and low art. Liz Kane, a student who helped organize this section of the exhibition.
The Institute of Contemporary Arts opened in London the year right after World War II ended as a way to encourage artists and new artistic development, but some of its younger members soon got tired of what they saw as its conservative values and emphasis on pre-war modernism. So in 1952, these younger artists joined with a circle of architects and art critics to form the Independent Group. It wasn't really an artistic movement as much as it was sort of a multi-dimensional study group, with all the members connected by their shared enthusiasm for technology, popular culture, and science fiction. By celebrating these aspects of culture which weren't typically acknowledged in artistic discourse, the Independent Group really worked to break down the distinction between high and low art, a project which was simultaneously being taken up by Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, and later Andy Warhol in the United States.
Comprising more than 100 objects in a variety of media, the Out of Albion exhibition charts the rise of a national British school, the birth of photography, and the emergence of modernism, and demonstrates once again the richness of the Allen Memorial Art Museum's holdings. Thank you for listening to this podcast, which was produced by the Allen Memorial Art Museum at Oberlin College. Be sure to check back for more additions to this series at our website, www.oberlin.edu/amam/tech.